from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, there's a good deal of solid evidence that internet companies are booming once again. With startups proliferating and the return of big internet IPOs, is it time to buy or to sell? And if another boom is on, can a bus be far behind? We'll take all that up and more in the hour ahead as we focus on what some are calling a new bubble in the world of high tech and Silicon Valley. Forum is next, right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to Forum. The Economist isn't the only place where you can find a good deal of highlighting of this being a new bubble for high tech, with startups emerging fast and furious here and abroad, and enormous values accruing to the likes of Facebook, valued at $76 billion, and Twitter, valued at $7.7, as well as higher prices for fledgling firms in the private market, and Microsoft recently purchasing Skype. There is a resurgence of mergers and acquisitions among tech companies, and we are witnessing a return of big internet IPOs. And what does it all mean? And should you think, if you're in the investment frame of mind or own stocks or buying or selling? Well, we take all that up in this morning's opening hour. And Martin Giles is here with us, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. Good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're talking about, what here, we call it a nascent bubble, bubble 2.0.
I wouldn't call it bubble 2.0, but it's a new bubble, but it's a different bubble. What you're seeing is an explosion of interest in, particularly in social media companies. So you mentioned Facebook, for example, valued on a private market at $76 billion. I mean, that's more than Ford. That's more than Boeing. Now, is it conceivable that that company and other social media companies are going to be incredibly valuable in the future? Possibly. But I think some of the valuations you're seeing are just astronomic and probably, you know, a very clear signal of excess and irrational exuberance, to use a word that the governor of the Federal Reserve once used about financial markets.
Irrational exuberance that may come because there are a lot of angels looking for startups and looking to invest.
Well, it's almost like, you know, if we're going to use the term bubble 2.0, it was beget by bubble 1.0, because a lot of people made substantial amounts of money in the first bubble. And then a lot of people who left companies like Google left with a great deal of money from their stock options. And now what's happening is that's being plowed back into all of these social media startups. And it's this wall of money pouring in that's almost, it's indiscriminate. You know, what you're starting to see is companies with no product, sort of no real track record, you know, getting valuations of $100 million or more at the startup phase, which is, frankly, pretty scary, I think.
And maybe crazy, too.
Well, you know, some of these may turn out to be the next Google. One or two of them may turn out to be the next Google, but not 100 of them. And you can see what's happened. Two things very clearly have changed between the last bubble and this one. The first is the cost of starting up a company, particularly an internet company, has plummeted dramatically because you've got a lot of new technologies around, like cloud computing and others, that have reduced the price of launching a startup. You can do it on your credit card now. The second thing that's changed is that we all are now plugged into the internet in ways that we weren't back 10 years ago. There are now 2 billion netizens compared to around about 200 or maybe even less than that back 10 years ago, 200 million. And so you've got this explosion of people on the internet, this cost of launching going down. And what that's meant is there's been an explosion of entrepreneurial activity. That's great, so long as each one of those companies has a real clear differentiated advantage over the others. And I don't think that's the case. There's a lot of crowd madness going on here.
Crowd madness, as you say, because of cheap cloud computing capacity and a platform that's reaching millions.
That's right. And I think that there's a third factor going on here as well, which is, you know, the last bubble was really an American bubble, a little bit of Europe. We in Europe were fair bit behind the US in terms of entrepreneurial endeavors, but we we're catching up a bit, but this time it's a really global bubble. You're seeing...
Especially China.
China.
Yeah.
And China here in the US, that's the interesting thing. It's a lot of Chinese internet companies like Renren, which is a sort of Facebook of China. You've got Youku, I hope I pronounced that right, which is the equivalent of YouTube in China. And these companies are listing on American stock markets. They're listed on the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange, on the NASDAQ. And you're seeing, again, when they go public, immediately their share prices soar by 40-50%, maybe, you know, more in some cases. And so there's a sort of global mania forming, which we didn't see last time around. So could that pump up this bubble bigger than last time, perhaps?
Talking with Martin Giles, who is U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist, and all this excitement, this exuberance, as you call it, or as you refer to it, one has to take a step back and just consider the fact that political implications, for example, vis-a-vis China, are not being considered. And for that matter, there's a lot of skimping on due diligence, isn't there?
I think you're absolutely right. Both of those things are quite striking here. I mean, I think let's take China first, and then we'll come to due diligence. With China, it's quite conceivable that the government could shut down at some point one of these big internet companies. You know, we've seen Facebook, we've seen LinkedIn. American internet companies have problems with the kinds of content that's vehicled over them in China, or being blocked from actually operating in China. Now, Chinese internet companies tend to play by the government's rules, but it's not inconceivable that sooner or later one of them will find itself, you know, in the sights, the crosshairs of the censors there, who will be very upset with some kind of information that's vehicled across it and be shut down. Now, that's not going to happen to Facebook or LinkedIn, but it could quite possibly happen to one of these Chinese companies. And I don't think that risk is priced in. Due diligence, come to that point now. The due diligence on startups here, there is such competition among angel investors who are investing in these young companies that I'm hearing reports of people coming into meetings with term sheets, with deal sheets already drawn up and just saying, you know, basically pretty much sign here. We've decided we want to back you. And, you know,
there's... drives up the valuation.
Which drives up the valuations dramatically because everyone's being played off. Now, again, might some of those investments pay off? Quite possibly. But I think, you know, there's a lack of discrimination here, which has got to be worrying.
Well, look at the numbers. Social media networks are up. Startups are up by over 50% over the past year. And then there's e-commerce that has to be figured into this as well, because the market is over 10 times what it was, or the expectation is it would be 10 times what it was last year by 2015.
That's right. So you've got valuations up for startups in the social media space around 50% year on year, which is just an astonishing rise. You have, at the same time, you have this prediction that e-commerce will expand rapidly and that these companies will benefit from, you know, advertising, digital advertising related to e-commerce, perhaps even sales, e-commerce sales. Now, it's a very delicate balancing act. You know, you have to sort of put the risks against the possible rewards. The possible rewards, I agree, are greater than they were perhaps even last time round. But the possible risks, particularly in the case of Chinese internet companies, are great too. And I think they're being underestimated in some cases at the moment.
Again, we're talking to Martin Giles, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. Let me open the phones and invite those of you listening to certainly join this conversation. You're welcome to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your involvement in the conversation and any questions or comments you might have. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And you can join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Do you think, indeed, there's another bubble? And if so, how does it differ from the last one? And what about bubbles bursting? Because that's usually what follows subsequent to when we talk about a bubble. You can also, by the way, email your thoughts to us or any questions or comments you might have at our email address, which is simply forum@kqed.org. Or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. We're talking about how things are moving in terms of other markets globally, and China has to be singled out. But Russia, too, is playing a central role in all
of this. Yes, Russia in two senses. One, in the sense that internet
companies are coming from Russia to America to list on US exchanges. Last week we saw Yandex, which is, again, a very big social media company and search company in Russia, listing in America, and its shares shot up by about 50% on the first day. But at the same time, you're seeing money come from Russia and pouring into American internet companies. There's a very big investment fund called DST, which was one of the earliest investors in companies like Facebook, and has made, you know, a staggering amount of money from being early, but that money still is coming. You know, they've launched new funds, or they're in the process of launching new fund, and we can see that this really is a sort of global flow of money, whereas, again, last time round, it was principally a sort of developed market flow of money. So the pot's much bigger this time.
So what do you advise investors? I mean, not necessarily that you have a crystal ball here, but nevertheless, if people are concerned about the bubble bursting or not knowing whether to buy or sell at this time, you know, one obviously has to be cautious. But what's the wisdom here?
Well, it's tulip bulb mania, which is the very first big bubble that this the world economy saw. It's hard to call one tulip bubble from another without doing your due diligence very carefully. I think, you know, it's very easy to sort of get carried away with household names. You know, everybody knows Facebook, everybody knows Twitter, and less so LinkedIn, but LinkedIn among professionals, it's very well known. So it's tempting to think, well, these are household names, therefore whatever valuation is given to them, that's good. And not to do the due diligence. And I think it's very important to go down and look at the numbers. I mean, when LinkedIn went public, you know, its share price soared over 100% at one point. Now, it's got some very good revenues. It's a very relatively solid company, I think, compared to many other internet companies. But the kind of multiples that were being applied to it were breathtakingly high. And I think, you know, even its managers, if they were honest, would say, you know, we're going to struggle to meet those kind of valuations.
It's very dangerous, really, isn't it? I mean, when you think about it, because all of that exuberance was also true the last time around. And we had, you know, petfood.com and all these things.
That's right. I mean, it's almost the second. What I worry more about, perhaps more than this first tier that are coming to market, this first tier look pretty good. You know, some of them have billions of dollars of revenues, the likes of Groupon, which is an online discount company, Zynga, a social gaming company based here in San Francisco. You know, some of these companies have very good revenue streams, which wasn't true last time around. What I worry about is almost the Zynga wannabes, the LinkedIn wannabes. It'll be the second and third round that follow this first round of IPOs, of initial public offerings, that will be the ones who will not be quite so good, but will pretend that they're worth as much as the first bunch. They're the ones to really watch out for.
Well, let's see what our listeners have to say on this score. Gregory, we'll begin with you. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to find out, you know, what kind of lifespan some of these businesses are projecting, because, you know, the way I look at them, something like Google, you know, it's diversifying its services, you know, from everything. And I think, like, things like, you know, if you look at MySpace and how quickly it died and how the public kind of moves on to the next thing, you know, the lifespan of these new companies, what do you think, or, you know, how do they project that?
It's an excellent observation, an excellent question. I think that with Google, you could see there was sort of a real sort of first mover advantage in the search space. You know, arguably, a company like Facebook has that same kind of advantage in social media. But as you rightly point out, you know, for a long while, MySpace was seen as the sort of leader of the social revolution. And even before MySpace, there was Friendster. Remember that? Yeah, so I would think social media is more fickle than, say, internet search or other kinds of internet activity. So I think there has to be more risk priced into these kinds of companies.
And yet these angel investors are battling for these startups, aren't they?
They are. They are very, very keen, because they're all hoping they're going to pick the one among the portfolio that they invest in that does turn out to be the next Facebook.
Let's find out what more of our callers have to say. And we'll go to Palo Alto. Mayank, good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me. I just have a quick question on the fact that bubbles are actually needed to form the next Google and to find the next big company. And you need these investments and encouragement for entrepreneurs to basically find the sweet spot, if you will, to form the next big thing. So what do you guys think about that?
It's a very interesting point. I think you have two reactions to that. The first is, well, yes, bubbles are needed, but bubbles are
dangerous as well. You know, they don't have no consequences to the individuals who invest and then lose their shirts when the bubble bursts. So you know, one can see the upside, and there is indeed some upside. You know, out of the last bubble came amazing companies like Google. And I do think, though, that there is something to what you say about the entrepreneurial drive that bubbles create. I mean, where else in the world would you give, you know, millions of dollars to spotty 22-year-old kids, you know, without giving them random drug tests all the time and kidnapping two of their family to make sure that they don't squander it? Here in Silicon Valley, it's an amazing creation machine where you can, you know, incense youngsters to come up with brilliant ideas. And the bubble, the prospect of making, you know, huge amounts of money in a relatively short space of time does attract people from all over the world. And I think you have a point that this is, you know, there are benefits out of this kind of boom and bust. But nevertheless, I think if you look at the fallout from the last bubble, that was pretty shocking and pretty painful for lots of people.
Well, has there been the important lessons learned from that, do you think? Or is this just, you know, we'll go into the dark again here because we're going to make a lot of money?
I think there have been some lessons learned. And I think if you look again, as I said, at this first round of companies coming to market, you know, they do have real revenues. It's not like the pets.com or boo.com of last time round, where there were basically, it was air. There was nothing there apart from the advertising, and there was lots of that. This time round, you know, these companies, some of them have been built with real revenues, a real clear business model, and perhaps longevity. But I think behind them, and you can see this happening at the angel level, at these young companies, behind them, there are a whole series of new businesses getting funded that really don't have anything solid behind them. And when they come from the private market to the public market, that's when we're really going to worry. Now, that could take, you know, 2-3 years from now to happen, but it's going to happen.
One of the reasons, perhaps, that the angel investors are as hungry as they are, I mean, in addition to what you said about the birth having taken place from the previous bubble, is there's a lot more money out there that needs to find a place to rest. I mean, everything has changed because of the mortgage crisis. Everything has changed because of the financial crisis on Wall Street. And so investors are in a real different ballgame here, aren't they?
I think they are. I think it's an excellent point. There are, you know, relatively few attractive investment opportunities that could return potentially the kinds of multiples you could see on an investment, an early investment in something like a Facebook or a LinkedIn right now. And so you have this money from hedge funds, from private equity companies who really, this isn't their ballgame. You know, all of a sudden they can't find enough returns in their own businesses. So that money is being steered into startups, into the venture area, which unnerves some venture capitalists who have told me, you know, they're worried about the kind of valuations being given to some of these companies because these guys don't understand tech. You know, that's not their real ball game. And then you have mutual funds coming in now. You've got the T. Rowe Prices of this world. So our money is now being invested, even though we might not know it, through some of these mutual fund companies. So there's a real wall of money coming in that has to make you stop and think twice about whether this is all going to be sensibly invested.
Our guest, if you've just joined us, is Martin Giles, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. A recent article in The Economist warns of a nascent bubble forming in high technology company valuations. An initial public offering by the social media site LinkedIn raised twice the amount of money projected, and excitement is growing about expected public offerings from Twitter, Zynga, and Facebook. But many pundits disagree, and we're talking about, well, the signs of a bubble and what it all means. And you can certainly add your voice to this. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And Lee is on to disagree with even the notion that there's a bubble. Hi, Lee. You're on.
Yeah. I don't think there is a bubble as such as it used to be before in late 90s. I think it is a similar situation when banks have a lot of money, but there's no place to necessarily, they are not putting into mortgages or other financing programs because of the crash. So the same thing is happening to the investment firms, and they are now only putting the money in where there's a solid experience behind the idea, there's a good idea, and they're investigating it a lot more. Many companies like Air.com and things in the late 90s. So I don't think there's a bubble. I think there's a very calculated growth. There's a very fundamentals now are very strong in terms of looking into the possibility of having a company or idea. So I will take your comments off the air. I totally disagree. There is a bubble.
Well, we thank you for voicing your disagreement, and Martin Giles.
Yep, I hear what you say, but I respectfully disagree with it. I think that you are right in some cases that investments are being made, particularly, I think, by some of the venture capital community here who have a long experience in this field. They are looking quite carefully at the kinds of risks and potential rewards that are associated with these social media investments. But I think, you know, you've only got to look at that LinkedIn performance on its day one, you know, 100% plus rise in share price. You know, its shares were trading at one point at over 400 times, over 500 times its income from last year. You know, those are astonishingly high multiples that not any kind of rational calculation could justify. Now, it's one example, and LinkedIn is actually one of the better companies. So I think, you know, if that's a weather vane, it's a weather vane that's pointing towards stormy, not towards calm.
When Microsoft buys Skype, for example, does that set off a certain kind of fever?
It does. Now, so Microsoft bought Skype for $8.5 billion of cash. And Skype was one of those companies that one had assumed would go public, so would become would be quoted on a stock market. Now, Microsoft stepped up and snapped it off the table very quickly at around $8.5 billion, which, again, is an incredibly large sum of money for a company that has relatively small revenues. Now, it's a household name. It's used quite widely. Is video going to be something that grows in the future? Absolutely. So Microsoft is betting that video will take off. But the company has found it, Skype has found it very hard to generate substantial advertising revenues. In fact, substantial revenues at all. And one has to wonder whether $8.5 billion is more a sign of desperation on the part of Microsoft, which is very keen to try and reestablish its image as a cool tech company, having lost it to the likes of Apple and others, or whether this is actually a sane kind of investment. And I absolutely don't think it is.
Well, in some instances like that, you have a company that, as you said, has a great brand name, is popular, has a great future potentially, but there's not necessarily the monetization. There's not necessarily, in other words, a way of bringing in the capital.
Well, that's right. But then, if I'm a shareholder of Microsoft, I might want to ask that question. Why are we buying this when, perhaps we could generate either our own kind of video offering, or find some other kind of company that we don't have to splash out an incredibly high sum of money for? And I think that if you look at what's happening, there are a few very, very well-established consumer internet brands like a Skype, like a LinkedIn, that have become household names. And they're the ones where this money is really pouring into and where a lot of corporate interest is focused. So it's almost like a supply and demand issue. There isn't enough supply, and there's one heck of a lot of demand. And therefore, you can get some irrational exuberance among corporates as well as among small investors.
So what do you think? Are we in a boom, a bubble? And if so, can a bus be far behind, or far ahead, I should say? Feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Our guest, Martin Giles, will continue with him, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with the economist Martin Giles and scanning the horizon for signs of a bubble. In fact, really one of the questions that's at the center of and framing this discussion is whether or not we are in a bubble. And indeed, if we are, it's a nascent bubble, or if it's another kind of boom or boomlet or whatever you want to call it, what it means in terms of investment and whether you should buy or sell. And just how that whole prospect looks. You can read, of course, the recent article by Martin Giles in The Economist. And, of course, you're welcome to join us in the program either by email or posting question or comment on our website. Our email address is forum@kqed.org or calling us when a line becomes available. It's toll-free 866-733-6786. And let's go to our calls. We'll go next to Oakland. Sean, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Speaking of recent articles, I remember reading an article in the New York Times by Joe Nocera just after the LinkedIn initial public offering, and it was pretty scathing about how, if I understood it right, the gist of it was how the LinkedIn folks were kind of ill-guided by the underestimating the initial public offering so they could benefit all their shareholders and trade on the outrageous price as it went up during the day. And I just wonder how much the banks are playing into all this since they're not making money the traditional ways anymore and making money so much off by trading and things like that. How is this contributing to the bubble and the situation?
So the question is really, are investment banks mispricing these offerings, i.e. setting the price too low so that when the shares start trading, then all of a sudden, all of their clients who've invested at that low price suddenly make a massive profit because the shares leap? There has been a lot of criticism of the investment banks around this pricing issue. And LinkedIn was clearly the first big social media IPO from an American company for a long time. And so you could just see the risk here. Now, in defense of the banks, if you look at the secondary markets, there are these markets where you can buy and sell shares of companies that are still private that have yet to go public. And there it's basically wealthy investors, investment funds, so pretty sophisticated people. And LinkedIn was trading anywhere sort of between $3.5 to $4 billion in terms of valuation. So when the investment bank set the price at $4.5, it didn't look ridiculous. Now, did they think it was going to go much higher than that? I suspect they did. The question is how much higher? And there has been an outcry among the investment community, and I think the next set of IPOs that are coming up, you have Zynga, you have Groupon, you have Facebook, all rumored to be going either later this year or in early 2012. They will be watched like hawks to see if the same thing happens again. Are the investment banks feathering their clients' nests, or are they really taking the company's interests to heart?
Let me thank the caller. And an apt question from one of our listeners who writes, is there a tangible metric used for assessment of Internet companies? For example, Ford would be assessed based on the number of cars manufactured and sold. Is the transparency of such metrics as simple as in other manufacturing industries?
It's an excellent question. There's a lot of debate around the kinds of metrics that should be used to value social media companies. The sort of revenue per user type model is in the first Internet bubble, it was simply eyeballs. It's just how many eyeballs do you have on your website, and let's assign a value per eyeball. This time around, the sophistication has grown, but nevertheless, it's still an inexact science. And I think your revenue per user, for example, in the case of LinkedIn, one would trying to assess how much revenue you would get from advertising, from users using the premium services, paying for the premium services that a LinkedIn provides, and from companies who purchase licenses from LinkedIn to search its database for potential employees. Now, all of those are different revenue streams. How much is each user on LinkedIn going to generate in terms of revenues off those streams? It's tough. It's very tough.
It's not like Ford.
It's not like Ford at all.
Another listener writes, let's make sure our history is accurate. Google did not have the first major mover advantage. Yahoo, AltaVista, Northern Light, Excite, and many more preceded Google. Google wasn't anywhere near the first. They just did it better.
That's true. And I think if you look, there are a number of companies out here. Facebook was not the first social network, as one caller pointed out earlier on. MySpace was there before it.
And Friendster.
Yes, remember Friendster. Rest in peace. Friendster was there before. So it's been a sort of perfectioning of move towards better and clearer offerings to the market all the way along. But then there have been sort of novel breakout companies. I mean, Groupon definitely, you know, knew the online discounting world was really not around, you know, even a couple of years ago, and they have exploded from nowhere to take it. So there's a mixture of people who are first movers and ones who have taken a lot longer to get where they are.
Question of an ominous nature from one of our listeners named Jerry says, a number of people have been concerned since the bank bailout that there would be a new bubble and the collapse would be worse for the economy than the housing bubble. How bad could this bubble be for the United States and the world?
Okay. I think some people would say the bailout of the banks has actually contributed to the current bubble.
I think that's true.
What's happened? You've pumped, you know, yeah. Helicopter Ben Bernanke has flown over the banking system and dumped, you know, billions of dollars.
Is this a common nomenclature for him?
He is known as Helicopter Ben because he has done a fantastic job of keeping the banking system afloat. When had it gone down, it would have been, you know, catastrophic, not just for the US, but for the world. So that's not a criticism per se, but what has happened, you know, naturally whenever you print lots of money and pump it into the economy, there are risks that it will appear in concentrated places and cause a bubble. So some people have said, well, perhaps, you know, some of this money has actually inflated the current bubble that's forming. Now, will it burst and have catastrophic consequences for the US and perhaps for the broader economy? I think my prediction on this is it is less likely to have catastrophic consequences than the previous bubble in one sense. And that sense is last time round, what happened, it wasn't just internet companies that whose share prices inflated. You know, the NASDAQ, which is the stock market index on which most tech companies trade, soared because telecoms companies, you know, and other kinds of companies that were associated with the internet, all of their stocks boomed. And when the bust came, it wasn't just internet companies whose share prices plummeted. It was telecoms and a wide range of other companies too. So all kinds of investors were burnt by this. This time round, for now, the bubble is very concentrated in internet stocks. On the other hand, you see it's a global bubble, as we talked about earlier. You're asking me about China. It's an excellent point. You know, there is a global interest here, a global mania going on.
And it's kind of all synergistically bound, isn't it?
It really is. It's all feeding off each other. You know, China, when Chinese internet companies see their share prices rise very sharply, then, of course, everyone thinks, well, a LinkedIn and a Facebook, they must be worth even more than these companies. So, boom, off they go too.
Our guest again is Martin Giles. He's with The Economist, U.S. technology correspondent. And our guest caller now, excuse me, our next caller is Scott from Mountain View. Hi, Scott.
Yes.
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. I was just wondering, I'd like to get Martin's take on the latest deal where Yahoo put a bunch of money into Alibaba, and then Alibaba in China ended up spinning off the most lucrative part of their company and cutting Yahoo completely out without their knowledge. And I'm just wondering, what do you think the ramifications in terms of the complications with the respect to the Chinese government are on these kinds of deals, and whether or not that's been built into the calculations or the risk?
Right. I think that particular case, you know, it's a case that is very complex and is, I'm told, in the process of being resolved between the two companies. But I think the fact that it happened at all, that there was this complete disconnect between Yahoo based here and Alibaba based in China shows you that there is a sort of gulf still between our understanding of corporate governance in the West and the way corporate governance can operate in places like China, if it operates at all. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier on about Chinese internet companies coming to the US. You know, one company, Renren, when it floated the same day, the chairman of its audit committee resigned. And you have to just wonder how robust the controls are internally in those companies and the quality of the information that's coming out of them.
They don't do such a great job of controlling things that are sent out that have toxicity to them and the like.
It's a very difficult situation. On the other hand, you know, one has to look at China and say, you know, that economy is growing like crazy. There are real opportunities there. Some of these entrepreneurs who are working, including the entrepreneur who launched Alibaba are phenomenal business people, and they have produced some remarkable companies. So you can't sort of blanket rule out investing in Chinese companies. But again, what I said earlier on holds. Caveat emptor, be careful, look very closely. And when you see a case like this, it should be a warning signal for investing in other Chinese firms.
Let me thank the caller. What's been the response in Silicon Valley to your article in The Economist?
I wouldn't say there's widespread agreement with it. Let me put it like that. I think there are a fair number of people who would say, well, Martin, you really don't understand what's happening. This time it's different. Now, you know, I've been in journalism 23 years, and the number of times I've heard that phrase, I could say, is probably more than 23, that's for sure. This time it's different for three reasons, Martin. Number one, there are 2 billion people on the internet. Last time there were only around, you know, 100 million odd. This time it's different because broadband connections are ubiquitous, so we can pump a lot of information very cheaply out to people, and people can get information back very easily. And number three, it's different because this time there are a bunch of companies out there with some real revenues and real business plans. And I'd say to those things, they are valid points, but you know, there are evidence. There is very clear evidence across the board of bubble-like activity, both at the late-stage companies where valuations are just clearly way out of whack with the kind of revenues and potential revenues that some of these companies have, and at the early stage among these angels, where these angels are behaving very badly.
Angels with dirty faces.
Angels with dirty faces.
Well, there was also something in your article about bumper stickers saying, you know, pray for another bubble or whatever. And there's the old Chinese proverb, you know, be careful what you wish for.
That's absolutely right. Yes, just sometime after the first bubble burst here in Silicon Valley, you know, there were bumper stickers around that said, please God, just one more bubble. And as you're right, you know, the Chinese proverb says, you know, be careful, you get what you wish for, you've got it. So now the new bumper sticker should be, please God, give me the wisdom to sell before it's too late.
And we go to more of your calls, and David joining us from Alameda. Hi, David.
Yes. So venture capitalists expect 9 out of 10 investments to fail. I'm wondering if Martin could envision some mechanism so that individual contributors that get stock options in startups could pool them to mitigate the risk.
Wow, that's a novel thought. I hadn't thought about that. Your venture capitalists do make many bets, and they expect, as you rightly say, they expect 9 out of 10 to fail. I think the issue is how you can pull. There are mechanisms, as I mentioned earlier on, there are secondary markets now around. There's likes of Second Market and SharesPost that are effectively places where you can go to buy and sell private shares if your company allows you. So it is conceivable that, let's say, you have some stock in LinkedIn and you think, wow, this is a pretty rich valuation. I'm not sure we're ever going to grow into that. I might cash in some now. You know, you could take your stock. Actually, probably LinkedIn you can't now because you've gone public. But for other companies who haven't yet gone public, you could take that stock, sell some of it if your company will allow you to do so on that market, and then buy shares from other people in other private companies that want to sell themselves.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of our emails. And you can email us forum@kqed.org or join us by phone at 866-733-6786. That's toll free, 866-733-6786. Mike says, I was hoping if you could ask your guests how regulatory bodies can proactively reduce the risk of irrational exuberance happening in the future.
It's very difficult for regulatory bodies to reduce, to proactively try to deflate this kind of bubble. Investors, the great wonderful thing about America is it's free and open markets. If people want to bet on a stock that they think is worth 50 when in fact it's worth 25, you know, this is a nation that will let you do that. And I think it's very difficult for regulators to say, actually, that's the wrong price. But what they can do is two things. The first is to make sure that there are clear and transparent information around for all parties involved, so that you don't get some kind of, you know, inside group that has information that the outsiders don't have. And then the second thing they can do is to make sure that the corporate corporate governance of these companies is run according to the very highest standards. And I think, you know, we've already touched on some of the concerns around those issues that engulf some of the companies that are listed on American exchanges. And I think the Securities and Exchange Commission should be keeping a very close eye on the way in which some of these companies are operated and making sure that where there are problems, they're addressed promptly.
Well, one also can look back, we'll say the SNL crisis and things of that sort. And again, caveat emptor and a bit of concern and apprehension about the fact that there's been a resurgence, as I said earlier, mergers and acquisitions among tech firms. And that ought to give us caution.
That's right. I mean, I think you can see that there are a number of very large technology companies around there, Microsoft being one we talked about earlier on the program, who have a boatload of cash sitting in their coffers that they have conserved during or built up during the downturn. And now they're ready to spend it. So they are in process of buying companies. In fact, some of the companies they buy simply to get hold of the people who are in them. They then promptly shut down the company. They're basically buying talent. But there are these mergers like the Microsoft Skype deal where you see concentration beginning. Now, I think right now there's no reason for alarm bells to ring overly, although perhaps in somewhere like the telecoms market where you have AT&T trying to buy T-Mobile USA, there have to be alarm bells ringing there. But we need to watch this very closely because it could become a serious public policy issue.
Martin Giles here with us in studio, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. And Michael writes, Mr. Giles speaks appropriately about conducting necessary due diligence before investing in any technology startup. I'm curious what kind of due diligence can be conducted by the average investor on such companies.
Well, it's a very good question. And I think it's hard because a lot of these companies, obviously, they're private companies, so they aren't under any obligation to reveal large amounts of information about themselves if you're buying in the private secondary market, if you're a wealthy investor. But when they come to the public markets, when they are quoted on the New York Stock Exchange or on the NASDAQ, they are required to reveal a great deal of information about themselves. Now, of course, they're going to try and paint themselves in the most positive light. That's a logical, economically rational thing to do. So the job of the average investor is to try and inform themselves as much as possible by reading around, looking critically at some of the claims that are made in those prospectuses to judge whether they are appropriate or not. But it's difficult. And one hopes that if your money is with a mutual fund or with some other kind of pooled investment company, that they are employing professionals who are looking very carefully at these companies' information and have a track record of doing so and remember what happened in the 1990s when, of course, a lot of information was pumped out that turned out to be completely and utterly useless.
When we talk again about irrational exuberance, you're talking about all these investors getting keen on getting into startups and putting their money with startups for the big buck bang and all that. It's not only the bank-led funds are hurting. We're also seeing private equity companies in the scramble here.
That's right. I mean, it's quite astonishing, really. I mean, these are companies that or investment funds that are used to sort of buying big industrial kinds of firms where, you can get your hands dirty ripping out machinery, reconfiguring the kind of operations of a car maker, an automotive parts maker or something like that. What do they know about this tech internet world? Now, they have hired some people who come from technology. So, I'm not suggesting for a moment they are completely ignorant, but, this is new territory for them. And, one has to think that they are going to make some pretty big mistakes. Now, maybe they can afford to make a few, but, that certainly is a new development here, and this is one reason why this bubble is different to the previous one.
And then we go to more of your calls. Tim, join us. You're on the air. Tim, are you there? Going once? Okay, then let's go to Amy in Oakland. Excuse me. Hi, Amy. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I've been a service provider to Silicon Valley startups for almost 20 years now, and I lived through the first bubble. And I think that these are all the right questions to be asking. I don't particularly think this is a bubble because I think the entire industry in Silicon Valley is much more sophisticated now than it was then. But I do have a concern and a question for Martin about an over-reliance upon advertising revenue. I just wonder how much advertising are us internet consumers to be expected to consume?
It's a good and important question, but I must ask Martin why he smiled when she said they're more sophisticated now than they were then.
Well, Amy, yes, I think some people are more sophisticated. I would agree with you that, but a lot of people are around who weren't, they're probably still in high school in 1999 who are now out there, and I'm not sure they necessarily have the memory that perhaps you do. But no, I think your question is spot on. Many of these models, of these social media internet models, are powered by the belief that there are going to be billions upon billions of dollars of online advertising revenue coming to these kinds of firms. Now, yes, the answer is there going to be growth in online advertising? Absolutely. You can only have to look at what's happening to the media industry in which I operate. There has been a sea change away from sort of more traditional forms of advertising towards internet advertising. But there has to be a point in many areas where fatigue is going to set in. There's only so many ads that you can serve up on an internet screen or on a mobile phone before you absolutely annoy the users and you see usage levels fall. I am skeptical, for example, that Facebook will be able to generate the kinds of advertising revenues that some of its boosters claim. I think friends are wonderful people to engage with, but when I'm chatting with my friends, I don't want to be hit time and time again by ads. And so I think it's a really important issue. And again, it's something that people need to think very carefully about before they make internet investments.
Amy, we thank you. Thank you for the call. And Tim, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
I have the opportunity to participate in investing in Facebook with some pre-IPO shares. And I was wondering if your guests could give me some advice on that, since I don't have the opportunity to do much due diligence like you were just talking about.
So you've invested, Tim, or you're about to invest? I thought that was where you were off the phone earlier on, because you were probably buying some
stuff. I'm about to.
Okay. Well, I
he's waiting for you, Martin, to advise him.
I'm not a registered financial advisor. I don't want to get arrested on the radio for giving you investment advice. My message again is the same as it has been consistently through this program and in everything I have written about this phenomenon, which is that there will be winners and there will be losers in this this new internet world. It is conceivable that some of these first generation of social media companies that have been around for a while, that have generated billions of dollars of revenues, will turn out to be worth much more than the kinds of valuations that they are currently attracting in the private secondary markets. But I think there are vulnerabilities in some of their business models. Facebook has vulnerabilities like every other company does, that one needs to think very carefully about before investing. So I think that's safe without me getting arrested.
Good advice, and I don't think the handcuffs are appropriate on that one. Thank you for the call. Let me go to some more of your emails. Here's Jeremy, who says, your guest is focusing on the welfare of small and long-term investors, but bubbles benefit younger and poorer workers just starting their tech careers. Millennial technicians stand to gain tremendously in terms of skill and experience, but don't forget the little guy.
It's true that bubbles create jobs, in fact create lots of them, and I think one sign that there is a sort of bubble forming here in the Valley is the kind of what's happening in the labor markets. And it's quite astonishing. You see reports of people being offered $1 million packages to move from relatively established companies to young startups. It's not options, it's cash that's being offered in many cases. So there is a real fight on out there right now for the best talent. Now, That's good. That's good for the people who are involved. It's good for youngsters who are coming into the job market. You know, my tip is if you're thinking about a career right now and you're not sure what to do, data science. Go into the area, become a data scientist. They're people who look at these vast amounts of data that internet companies are producing and they pass them to look for trends in there.
So you're not going to get arrested for career counseling?
A career I'm fine on, although, you know, I don't have a wonderful track record there, I have to say. But I think data science is a pretty safe bet right now. There are opportunities here. Now, again, the question is, which companies are the companies I'm going to join solid? You know, do they have the company I'm thinking of joining solid? Does it have good growth prospects? Is it well run? Is the governance solid? All of those questions, same kind of due diligence. But it's very true. I think it's one of the reasons sort of, you know, Silicon Valley and the San Francisco Bay Area feels like a boom town compared to the rest of America.
Here's a listener makes a comment saying, this is Gene from San Jose, your guess is correct, too much money chasing very low returns. People are losing patience with 2% returns.
Yeah, 2%. I mean, it is hard, and it's understandable if you're looking for substantial returns, you're planning for your retirement, you're thinking, where am I going to get the kinds of returns that that will actually see me through to a comfortable retirement? Oh, you know, look at LinkedIn. My word, 100% on day one. Or Facebook. You know, I'm familiar with Facebook and my kids use it. My grandkids use it. Wow, this has got to be something that's wonderful. The temptation will be very strong to put some money into these things. And I think, again, you know, it may be that some of these investments will pay off, but that's a very risky. You know, if you're going directly into these companies, that's a very risky thing to do. Diversification across mutual, you know, sort of very broad areas.
Standard advice.
Standard advice is actually very good advice.
Of course, it's also standard advice to think of it often as a casino because it really the metaphor works. And I want to get a final caller on here, and that's you, Luke. Good morning.
Good morning. I just had a little bit of a comment more than a question about what you thought about the fact that these technology companies are more based on concepts and ideas and intangible assets more than traditional companies that have, say, plant, property, and equipment, so that if something does happen, it'll have some sort of a return for the investor, whereas the technology companies are more based, like I said, on information and data.
So I think your point is basically, so if an industrial company fails, at least there's the assets that are, you know, the tangible bricks and mortar plus the equipment and everything that you can liquidate and make some money out of. Whereas if a technology, is that the point?
That's the point.
That's the point. Yeah. And I think it is, it's an important point. But you know, what is happening is there is no doubt that we are in a new era in terms of the information economy. Data and databases, as I mentioned, these data scientists being in demand, data and databases are extremely valuable. They are used for all sorts of things, including targeting advertising, targeting e-commerce offers. You know, that information is very new, and it's different to where we've been before.
On that note, we'll have to conclude. Martin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Martin Giles, U.S. technology correspondent for The Economist. Sammy Hagar, up ahead in the hour we're coming to. Thank you for being part of this hour of Forum. I'm Michael Kress.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.